Case number 22-1264 et al. Axel Protective Services, Inc. Petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Ms. Mastroni for the petitioner, Mr. Jones for the respondent.
All right, Ms. Mastroni, whenever you're ready, please proceed.
All right, thank you. Maura Mastroni from Littler Mendelson on behalf of Excel. So as you know, I'm not going to rehash the briefs and decisions, but this case really hinges on the termination of a former employee of Excel, Mr. Mark Salopek, and he was a security guard for Excel for several years at a naval base in the state of Washington. He was terminated based on some events that occurred surrounding his communications with the Navy, reporting what he believed were alleged safety concerns. And so I think the first thing to address is whether this court can consider some of the arguments that we raised in our brief. I know that opposing counsel has argued that these are not properly before the court because they were not explicitly raised in our exceptions. And these two arguments have to do with whether Mr. Salopek's communications were protected under the act, and if so, whether they lost the protection of the act based on his failure to disclose an ongoing labor dispute. And we argue that these issues are properly before this court for a few reasons. One, we did raise an issue with respect to whether Mr. Salopek's communications were protected under the act in our exceptions. And this these
and,
arguments.
And where is that?
In
where
our exceptions?
Where precisely in your exceptions?
Sure. I'll give you the page number. So page 43 of our exceptions is where we start our argument about how Mr. Salopek's actions lost the protection of the act. So while we did not explicitly, I'm sorry.
I don't know that those, that this part of the exceptions goes specifically to that point though.
Right, I don't disagree with you there. We did not specifically address the two issues that we are advancing here. Our claim is that they are an extension of the argument that we did raise in our exceptions related to whether
how does what you said put the general counsel on notice that these are the claims that you're making?
So, I mean, we weren't specific about it. I'm not pretending that we were, but I think the idea is that they are an extension of what we argued, and these issues were discussed
at length. Is the test that it's just an extension, is that sufficient, or doesn't it have to put them on notice that this is what you're arguing? And you're conceding that it doesn't, correct?
No, I'm conceding that we didn't specifically address these issues that were raised by the dissent and discussed at length by both the dissent and the majority. So in that respect, the general counsel was on notice when we discussed these issues in our appeal.
The United Food case precludes us from relying on just what the dissent said.
I'm sorry.
You needed to read. So the fact that a dissenting board member raised these issues is not sufficient under our United Food precedent. And so I think that you need to argue that you did raise this, and all you're relying on is some general statements that it appears that you're conceding didn't put the general counsel on notice of these specific issues.
I think reading our brief and our exceptions rather is clear that we did not specifically argue the two issues that the dissent discussed and that we have argued in our brief before this court.
Okay, Ms. Mastroni, let me ask you about a different question. Sure. Is Excel arguing, did Excel argue before the board that Salopec was so disloyal that his actions came outside of protected activity. Is that what Excel is arguing in its brief before the board and in its exceptions?
We had argued that his comments were, you know, either felt in one of those categories, sufficiently disloyal, maliciously untrue, or just said and done recklessly. So our argument there was that they his communications lost the protection of the act because of those reasons. So because what he advanced in speaking with the Navy personnel was simply not true. And even if, you know, he didn't know for sure that they weren't true, which we dispute, but at least his comments were said recklessly with regard to the truth of what he was saying. So that
and
was
disloyally. Do you think that disloyalty is a separate cause for termination?
Is that what we argued?
Well, I'm wondering if that's what you've argued, if that's what you think is the standard.
No, I don't think we were arguing that disloyalty was a separate cause for his termination. But under the law, if his communications were so disloyal or maliciously untrue or reckless, then they could lose the protection of the act. And that's what
and
we were arguing.
And that disloyalty would be a separate grounds to it being maliciously untrue. To lose the protection of the act.
Yes, I would agree with you there. Yes, so it could be one of those three, right? Reckless, maliciously untrue, or so disloyal to lose the protection. And so his comments that, you know, the company had forged documents and, you know, was dishonest with the Navy, et cetera, were comments that could be construed as disloyal in addition to being maliciously untrue and or reckless.
So you've forfeited the disloyalty argument, but you did preserve the maliciously untrue argument, correct?
No, I don't think we forfeited the disloyalty in terms of losing the protection of the act. I don't think we forfeited that argument. I think that goes along with our argument that his communications were at least one of those, fell into one of those categories, right? Either sufficiently disloyal, maliciously untrue, and or reckless.
I'm sorry, did you make a specific argument about sufficiently disloyal? I thought your arguments relied on maliciously untrue.
Yeah, I think that was our focus, that they were, we said we discussed both them both being reckless and maliciously untrue in our exceptions.
Right, but you didn't specifically talk about sufficiently disloyal.
I think they all fell within that category. So whether they were, on the border of maliciously untrue, disloyal, at any rate,
I'm just asking about what you argued. I don't think you made a specific argument about disloyalty. You were arguing about maliciously untrue, is my recollection of it.
We focused on maliciously untrue and reckless as well.
And it seems to me that much of what was at issue was not, in fact, untrue. Didn't Captain Terry concede that there was a lot of activity that was not authorized under Navy regulations, such as firearms tests in unapproved places using equipment that was not provided by the Navy, et cetera? Like, what exactly are you saying was untrue?
The majority of his allegations about guards having qualified improperly were found to be untrue. I believe there were two allegations that he made that were substantiated. The rest, Mr. Rake found to be unsubstantiated based on his investigation, including a review of documents and interview of numerous other security guards.
But we don't rely on what Mr. Rake found. He was found to be biased. We should rely on what the board found.
I think we have to rely on the evidence in the record, and the evidence in the record speaks for itself. And the fact that the ALJ found that that Mr. Rake was biased. It was simply a determination he made that didn't necessarily comport with the evidence in the record. In fact, we don't think there was any evidence in the record that Mr. Rake was biased.
What about the statements that he made about Mr. Salopet?
I think that was his determination made based on his discussions with Mr. Salopet as part of his investigation.
So I'm sorry, are you arguing that the ALJ was clearly erroneous or that his finding was not supported by the evidence when he found that Mr. Rake was biased?
Yes, I think the evidence in the record did not support that Mr. Rake was biased against or, you know, held animus against Mr. Salopet based on the communications that he made.
Okay, thank you. You're a little over, but we'll give you some rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Jost.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Micah Jost for the Labor Board. I'll begin by briefly addressing the 10E issues that were just discussed. With regard to the requirement of specificity in raising these issues, the Nova case, which the employer cites in its reply brief at page 4, acknowledges that the employer does have to put the board on notice of the, quote, specific grounds for its objections. The employer did not do that here with regard to mutual aid and protection question, or the loss of protection with regard to disclosure of a labor dispute, nor did it make any argument as to disloyalty. When it comes to disloyalty, if you examine their exceptions document, which is at Joint Appendix 122 to 128, you will not find the word disloyalty on those pages anywhere. There's no reference to it because they focused exclusively on the question of malicious falsity. Nothing in their brief in support expands on that. They do reference disloyalty in passing at page 44 of that document in a quote from the Valley Hospital decision, which simply sets forth the overarching standard. They never actually try to explain why that would apply here.
Both the ALJ and the board discuss the loyalty point, which was raised. I mean, we looked at the brief that was presented before the board, which does mention the disloyalty point. And so it seems that they did raise that point before the board. And then the board does discuss it, makes a specific finding about it, as does the ALJ.
Your Honor, the board addressed it because it was raised in a dissent. The board explained that it had not been raised by the employer. And there is simply nothing, again, the exceptions document is where the employer has to begin to put the board on notice. It can expand on arguments that it's properly raised there in its brief in support under this
court
law.
I understand that as to some of the actions, but some of the arguments, but what about the disloyalty point, that the disloyalty here took this outside the protections of the act?
So disloyalty is a separate inquiry. This court's cases in Endicott and Hormel turn on disloyalty. They have nothing to do with malicious falsity. Similarly, Jefferson Standard doesn't touch on malicious falsity. It focuses on disloyalty. It is a separate issue, and the employer had to do more than reference the word disloyalty once in the middle of its brief in citing a case from the board. It never addressed disloyalty in terms of any of the board's cases or this court's cases. And in that context, the 10E decisions that we cite explain why the board was not on notice there. It's not enough.
Do you think it was not urged before the board and forfeited before this court, or just simply not urged before the board?
Well, it's both, Your Honor. But as far as the first question, it's jurisdictional. And so if it wasn't urged before the board, nothing they could say before this court could resurrect the issue.
Right.
And when you look at cases like the Spectrum Health decision from this court and Persephone Hotel, which are both cited in our brief, this court has recognized that a broad objection, for example, to the remedy in its entirety does not preserve a sort of subset of argument. In Persephone Hotel, a vague reference to the ALJ not being allowed to amend a complaint does not preserve a subpart of that argument based on statute of limitations, for example. So that's what we have here. At best, they made a reference to the overarching standard, but they never articulated an argument as to disloyalty. And in any event, the board addressed the issue because it was raised in the dissent. And as in DirecTV, the board made findings which are supported by substantial evidence that nothing here was flagrantly disloyal or wholly incommensurate with any grievances the employees could have. In fact, this case is essentially on all fours with DirecTV. The employees went to their employer first. They tried to resolve the issue in that way initially. They went to multiple people within their chain of command. And after that, they went to the next entity that they believed could help them. In doing so, they focused on issues relating to their working conditions. There's no evidence of critical timing or any sort of unusual damage that the employer could have faced. And there is no evidence that they had any intent to harm the employer unnecessarily. In that regard, I would emphasize Joint Appendix 111 to 112, where the ALJ found essentially as a matter of credibility that these employees were genuinely motivated by their safety concerns. There is ample evidence in the record to support that. In particular, at Joint Appendix 420, 462, 463, the employees testify in a credible way about the genuine concerns they felt for their own safety, both based on the risk of ricochets and other injuries that they might suffer at an unauthorized shooting location, and also their concern that having employees lacked sufficient qualification could put them in danger in the event of a critical incident. With regard to the question of whether this court can rely on Rake's findings, of course it cannot. What it has to defer to is the findings of the administrative law judge that the board adopted. And here the board did find that Rake essentially conducted his investigation based on his animus toward these employees going over his head and putting him in a bad position, where the employer's own witnesses acknowledged that the employees had been shooting at unqualified locations for their qualifications, and that Rake was on notice and was fully aware of those behaviors. So in the end, only two issues are properly before the court here, only two board findings. And those are the finding that Mark Salopek's complaints were not maliciously false, and the finding that the employer was motivated by those complaints to discharge him. On both of those points, the employer's own statements in its briefs and from its witnesses are fatal to its challenges. On the first point, there can be no malicious falsity because Excel admitted that the complaints were true. First, we have operations manager Terry testifying that Excel held those qualification shoots at other locations. Second, he confirmed that there is a document on which Excel misrepresented where that took place. That's at Joint Appendix 261, and his admissions are at 610 and 612. And Excel admitted that as well in its brief in support before the board, which is at page 45 of that document. Third, we have Palace's admissions that he altered targets. And finally, we have Excel admitting in its opening brief that Officer Kohler received weapons she had not qualified for after she attended a gravel pit shoot. She explains in her statement at Joint Appendix 244 that that did take place at a gravel pit.
What do we do if we conclude that many of the allegations were true, but maybe some were false? Do we then go on and assess, look at the false ones and assess maliciousness?
If there are any...
Or is it just a gestalt kind of, you know, overall there's a lot of truth in everything the employee was saying?
Your Honor, I think when the court looks at its decision in DirecTV, the focus there was on essentially whether the core allegations, whether the essential substance of the complaints were true. And in that case, the court looked at the complaints overall, looked at the issues that the employees had raised, and it was clear that they had an essential truth to them. I think the same is true for the Encore decision. The court looked at the statements that the employee raised with regard to meter bases catching fire and said these were perhaps not phrased as clearly as they could have been, but they are in their essence true. That is certainly the case here. The employer hasn't shown that anything was false. There may be a date that was ultimately corrected after being initially incorrect, but that sort of error just can't possibly qualify for malicious falsity. Even if they had established falsity as to any particular point, then the next inquiry would be whether it was knowingly false, or whether Salopek was reckless as to the truth or falsity. And there, the ALJ looked at the credible testimony of these employees, explaining how they reached these complaints, how they talked amongst themselves, how they checked each other's work, how they relied on each other's statements, and found that they were acting in good faith to raise what they believed to be true complaints. The employer, again, as to its ultimate unlawful motivation, it conceded in its briefs and in its own documentation and in the statements of its witnesses that it was motivated by this activity. And I haven't heard any counter argument on that note today. As many of the cases we cite explain, the DHSC case, Guardsmark, and even the Aroostook case that the employer brings up, those are decisions from this court recognizing that an employer cannot use an employee's decision to go outside the chain of command in order to punish them for their protected activity. So in view of the board's well-supported findings and substantial evidence that we've discussed, we ask for enforcement of the court's order in full if there are any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jost.
Thank you.
Ms. Mastroni, rebuttal?
Yes, I think just briefly, just with respect to the notion that the majority of Mr. Selenpack's allegations were true, I just think that's not accurate. And I think the record shows that we addressed this at length in our exceptions, starting on page 44.
What's your best illustration of a statement that was obviously materially false?
Well, I think that just one of his biggest claims was that Excel allowed officers to qualify at gravel pit ranges on several occasions. That was really the whole crux of his complaint here, that they were letting these officers qualify at gravel pit ranges. And this was, you know, not in line with what the Navy would have permitted. And that simply didn't bear out.
Didn't Captain Terry testify that that did in fact happen?
Not that employees were able to qualify there. And in fact, they had only one instance of this occurring. There was one document to support this. And so when Mr. Selenpack made this allegation, he was aware of only one specific instance where this did occur.
So why doesn't that one instance support the finding?
It doesn't support the... I'm not sure we mean the finding. I don't think it supports his allegation I'm sorry.
I guess we're reviewing for whether substantial evidence supported the board's decision. And it rejected the argument that there were, I guess, maliciously false statements. And when Judge Katsas asked you, what is your best evidence of a maliciously false statement, you referred to gravel pit qualification tests, but there's evidence in the record that Captain Terry, who works for your client, acknowledged that there were gravel pit qualification tests, and you just conceded that there's a document to support that there were gravel pit qualification tests. So why isn't that enough to sustain? All right, so why isn't that enough to sustain the finding?
Well, first of all, that's only one instance of his allegations that did not turn out to be true, because he said this happened on several occasions, and there's one document showing that it occurred once. But there are also numerous other allegations.
There was evidence of other ones. There's one document about one incident, but there was testimony that it happened on more than one occasion.
I don't believe that Mr. Terry was saying that the guards were allowed to qualify at the gravel pit ranges.
Find that.
We'll check that. My recollection is the same as Judge Pan's, which is you have testimony from Terry that's favorable to the board on that point. And you have officer, is it Kohler? And you have a falsified record, which put those three together, that seems like substantial evidence.
We went through at length the numerous allegations that he made that were found to be unsubstantiated through investigation. So that's our argument, is that he was making statements knowing that they were false, and or at least with reckless disregard as to whether they were true or false. And so in that way, we distinguish DirecTV because these were not good faith misstatements made by Mr. Selenpack. He was aware that he was making false claims, and or at least he was making these claims with reckless disregard as to whether they were true or false.
Okay. think we understand your position. Thank you very much. The case is submitted.